You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has been addressing his parliament following Greece's decision to delay its latest repayment to the IMF. I'll be asking my guests whether Greece is also delaying the inevitable. Also ahead, if you're a US citizen packing your flip-flops for Cuba, you may want to think again. After the House of Representatives votes to keep restrictions on citizens travelling to the island, we'll take the temperature of the so-called thaw in relations between the two states. And after the personal data of millions of US government workers is stolen, officials point the finger at Chinese hackers. We ask what's at risk and what the fallout could be. All that and more coming up right now on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24. And welcome to the programme. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, UK correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, among other publications, and Michael Binion, foreign affairs specialist for The Times. Welcome both. We will start with Greece, which has failed slash refused to make a €300 million repayment to the IMF, which was due today. This does not represent a formal default as such, but that may not be far off. Greece's bailout expires at the end of June, and as things stand, there still seems a wide gap between the ideas of Greece and its creditors vis-a-vis an acceptable solution. As we said at the top of the show, Alexis Tsipras has just finished speaking to Parliament. The opposition leader, Samaras, is now responding. Tsipras, and I'll put this to you first, Michael, Tsipras has said he wants a deal that he is economically viable and socially just. Can he have both?
Well, not according to many of the European negotiators. I mean, they say, yes, you can have a deal, but on the terms that we've talked about earlier. You can't keep changing the terms. You must introduce the reforms that were basically agreed some years ago and follow through on them. And they are getting increasingly frustrated that he appears to be sort of wriggling with the wording all the time, because he, although he says, I'm in favour of it and I will do these reforms, is up against a hardline faction in his own party, which says those are the red lines and you cannot cross them.
Sebastian Borger, Alexis Tsipras also said time is running out not only for us but for everyone. Have Greece become, you know, basically the man in that joke about how if you owe the bank, you know, £10,000, you've got a problem. If you owe the bank £10 million, the bank's got a problem.
Well, obviously the bank has a severe problem. And I mean, the European Central Bank and the European Union is I mean, that's the whole reason why we keep talking about the same problem. I still think every economist I've ever spoken to, who, as far as I can judge it, has any sense at all, has always said they will not be able to pay it back. So we will have to find a solution within the European framework of at least getting rid of some of their debts so they can make a new start.
Michael, I'm not an economist, and in fact I understand economics even less than many economists do, but it does seem fairly self-evident that, and in fact it seems self-evident now for what seems like longer than I've been alive, that this cannot go on, that this situation is obviously sustainable. Greece cannot keep going through this cycle of having to pay money they don't actually have. How far seriously do you think we now are from the actual crunch, Greece actually having to leave the euro or being thrown out of the euro?
Well, we're about 1 minute to midnight. It's just round the corner. It is impossible to scrape together the money for the IMF. They've shaken all the tins, they've emptied all the piggy banks, they've tried to bring in money from local authorities to scrape up money for the last repayment. There's no more to be found. And if they don't pay the IMF, then they're technically in default. And if they're in default, then the pressure grows with the European Union as well. And I think the point comes where the European negotiators themselves begin to think they're not serious. They can't do it. There is a problem that there are two things. I completely agree with Sebastian. They cannot ever repay it at the present rate of they're going. The Europeans are very reluctant to write off even half the debt, because it's a lot of money. But at the same time, the level of austerity that would be imposed on Greece to allow them to repay is so colossal that most Greeks simply cannot stomach that. And there you've got the two colliding forces. So some way, they've got to find a way out of that.
Sebastian, back in your home country, how have attitudes shifted or hardened, say, in the last year or so especially? There did always seem to be this, maybe 2 years ago, it did seem like it was all coming from Germany, this idea that the European Union must be preserved, the euro must survive at almost any cost. It seems to me, at least, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that over the last year or so, if not necessarily the German political establishment, but certainly the German people have started to get increasingly tired of this?
No, I think the German people have always been tired. And I still think that the establishment, if you mean by that the ruling coalition government, grand coalition government, is still wedded to the idea of keeping the EU and the euro together. And I still think, I know they're playing hardball, which they've got to do to some extent. I still think there'll be a deal and they'll keep Greece in the euro. I'm much more optimistic on that than Michael is.
Well, if optimistic is indeed the word. Michael, there are a couple of other interesting undertows, I thought, in what Tsipras has been saying, not just in his speech in the last few minutes, but in the last day or two. It's certainly been made known by his people that he had what was called a friendly chat with Vladimir Putin. And also, there is a rumour that does persist, and I think this is also emanating from Syriza, that there may be a snap election. And it just struck me that is this their way of hanging the threat of a Golden Dawn government of Greece over the EU?
Possibly. It's also a threat of opening the door to Russian influence at a time when the EU is
indeed extremely concerned.
And, of course, there are two key questions. One is, if they left the euro, would they have to also leave the EU itself? Now, that would be a big disaster. I mean, that would be a big political failure for the EU. Leaving the euro is not quite such a big failure, though it is in itself quite a damnation of the whole single
economically
currency.
Catastrophic for Greece. Let's not forget that. I mean, you talk about... I think that to be optimistic for Greece, you have to insist on them staying in the euro.
Because
it'll be a complete disaster. Well, the long term is a long time away.
Well, three, 4 years.
No.
Well, as opposed to the semi-complete disaster that we have presently.
Well, we've had a disaster in their economy for a number of years. In fact, the economy was growing again, and now the new government has completely messed it up again.
On that note, though, I guess if you think we are at 1 minute to midnight, Michael, suppose Greece does leave the euro.
Yes.
What actually is the worst that could happen?
Well, straight away, the banks run out of money. The country defaults. They can't borrow money anywhere. They then have to introduce their own currency, and there's a run. They have to effectively seal the borders, either physically or certainly in terms of money transfers. Otherwise, every single person with any euros sends it abroad or tries to find somewhere to put their money overseas. Everybody then is faced with colossal debts because any debt denominated in euros becomes extremely hard to repay. And in the short term, it is pretty chaotic. They then have to introduce the drachma almost overnight. And then it is probably immediately devalued by 50, 60, whatever percent the markets value it at. Then, in the long term, and I agree with Sebastian, that we're talking several years.
We're talking a decade.
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, they could theoretically then start earning the money with exports, with cheap tourism, with all kinds of things to pay their way. But, of course, what they're looking for is, or at least what the present government is looking for, is a possible saviour. And if the Russians are willing to come along, the problem is the Russians don't have the money. They haven't got the money themselves. I mean, they would try to exploit this opportunity. It's really more political bargaining than any realistic calculation.
I think the one thing we can agree on is that we will have ample further opportunity in the future to discuss this. So we'll come back to this one at a later date and move on to our next story tonight. It's not immediately clear, I suspect, to a lot of people why anybody would want to read the human resources files of an immense public sector bureaucracy, but clearly someone thinks it's worth the effort. The US government has acknowledged that databases belonging to its Office of Personnel Management have been hacked, exposing job assignments assignments and performance reviews of 4 million past and present employees. The US has blamed Chinese hackers. China has denied involvement. Sebastian, I'll ask you first. The stories like this, they're always a hall of mirrors involving sort of governments and hacking and espionage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How sure can we be that the US is actually admitting the full extent of what has been hacked?
Always great fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely, always great. But I've got to correct you, of course. They haven't denied it. All they've called it is to allege that we are responsible is irresponsible and unscientific.
You are, of course,
unscientific, marvellous.
You are, of course, entirely correct. It is what is known in the trade as the non-denial denial.
If it wasn't the Chinese, it was the Russians. I mean, we presume so anyway. I think it's a training exercise to get to rather more important U.S. agencies like the Pentagon or comparable Army, Navy, Air Force.
Well, the U.S. is being quick to claim that, you know, they haven't got hold of, whoever has done this hasn't got hold of any of the real fun stuff like security clearances, background checks, etc., etc., etc. Michael, as Sebastian says, like, the real fear here is that they don't hack. I mean, this is potentially irritating to 4 million people. And the U.S. government has said they will arrange insurance for, you know, identity theft against everybody affected. Will contact everybody affected, etc., etc. This is basically whoever's done this has caused a massive pain in the neck. How great is the danger, as far as it's possible to tell, of somebody causing rather more than that through similar means?
Yes, I think the danger is quite great. As you say, this really doesn't matter one way or the other. It's extremely unlikely that several hundred thousand people in Beijing are going to suddenly pose as American employees using false identities. And frankly, what on earth they're going to learn from finding out who's been employed under what terms is almost minimal. But it is a training exercise. There is, to some extent, simply the temptation. I mean, if there's any website in the world, someone in China will try to hack it, because that's what they like doing. It's fun and it's interesting and it's a challenge. And of course, it does have serious implications in that there are areas where they would very much like to get into the innermost secrets, not simply government areas, but scientific research, you know, things where they could gain massive commercial advantage if they could hack into systems that are sometimes quite closely guarded. So it's a real battle of wits in a way.
Is this one of those areas, do you think, Sebastian, at which, by definition, the outlaws will always be at least one step ahead of the law? Because it's in the interests of the hackers to be the ones who are always innovating, always thinking, whereas almost by definition, the ones defending from them can only react.
Well, whether that's true or not, I think it's a wake-up call, and maybe I wonder whether it isn't something that the U.S. government tells us about because they want both their own agencies as well as private companies and research institutions, etc., to be on their toes. Every military analyst, every intelligence service analyst you talk to will tell you that this kind of cyber warfare is increasingly the problem for the West. And so we've got to invest much more money into keeping our data systems safe.
Michael, how confident are you that the United States doesn't have people, as we speak, trying to do more or less exactly the same thing to databases in China and Russia?
I think they are doing that. Of course they are, and we've already seen it in action. I mean, the most famous case was disabling the Iranian nuclear capabilities.
With the Stuxnet virus.
Exactly, and they didn't exactly boast about it, but they made it pretty clear that suggestions that the US was behind it were perfectly on the mark, US and Israel.
Unscientific and irresponsible.
Yeah, there was a certain amount of non-denial going on there as well.
Well, of course they're doing this, and it's very important. And as Sebastian says, this is possibly one of the main faces of future warfare.
Do we reach the point, though, Sebastian? And it struck me reading, you know, around especially Cold War espionage and having spoken to a few people who were involved with it for their living, that you kind of eventually reach a point at which everybody's intelligence agencies and everybody's secrets are so compromised by everybody else that there's almost no point in having them.
That's the old adage, isn't it? I still think it needed to be done. Of course, you know, the East German intelligence service was 10 times better than the West German, and the Cold War ended the way it did. But still, no, I think it's slightly more serious than that, because we are so very dependent on data security nowadays with the network, our network world, that we really have to be on our toes about.
Well, you could cripple daily life overnight.
Absolutely.
You could cut off electricity. The water wouldn't flow. I mean, ordinary things that simply power our cities. You could bring them to a standstill within hours.
Amazing to think that you could now do far more damage far more quickly with a computer than you could do with a fleet of bombers in weeks,
yes,
isn't it?
Exactly. Straight away.
I wonder if that may end up meaning that war movies of the future are an awful lot less spectacular.
You don't blow things up, but everybody suddenly goes hungry and has no water.
Is it possible to tell how... I'll ask you each the same question, that question a different way. Are you surprised that this sort of thing doesn't happen more often? Are you surprised that there has not been an actually effective, you know, noticeable attack on infrastructure in that sense?
I think it happens all the time. I just think we don't know about it. I honestly think that this kind of, it was obviously quite major, but I think they could tell us about a similar thing every once a fortnight.
So could banks.
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, banks, absolutely.
I mean, I'm sure the attacks are constant, but we've never had the thing where water stops coming out of the taps or anything.
No, we haven't had that, no. But that would be effectively an act of war. And I think few countries would actually undertake something quite so brazen. I mean, a rogue hacker might try it just for fun or out of interest. But to disable the infrastructure of an entire city or a country, that is an act of war.
It is interesting that there's even a kind of morality developing around this.
Yes.
In that people sort of think, you know, you can do so much but not too far. I mean, all that will happen in this instance is that the United States will... you know, complain about China's behaviour. China will call the United States irresponsible and unscientific. I wonder if those have lost something in the translation. Those are interesting choices of words. but yes, we will take a short break now. Still with me are Michael Binion and Sebastian Borger. When we come back, was talk of the Grand Thaw in fact somewhat overstated? Cuba and the US next.
It's full steam ahead with the new transport-themed issue of Monocle that includes our survey of the best in class from cars to trams, planes to trains. Here's what our editors have lined up for you this month.
In the affairs section, we take to the subsidised skies in Montana, Queensland and Wales to find out why small airlines need big backing.
In this month's business section, we take up the transport theme with a visit to the small Japanese city of Kanazawa, put on the business and tourist map by the new Hokuriku Shinkansen, which began service in March.
In culture, we tackle transport by looking at Art Movers, the unsung multi-billion dollar arm of the art world.
The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to sign up now.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are my guests, Sebastian Borger and Michael Binion. Now, it has been the most dramatic foreign policy initiative of Barack Obama's presidency, a thaw in relations with Havana, with the eventual ambition of ending decades of pointless banishment of Cuba, which has accomplished little but keeping the Castros in work. Not everyone sees it as self-evident common sense, however. The Republican-controlled Congress has voted to uphold restrictions on U.S. citizens traveling to Cuba. Michael, are there... This is always the question with the Republicans, and it's always a tricky one. Are they acting from actual conviction here, or are they just trying to annoy the president?
Both. They're acting certainly to annoy the president, because that is pretty well the overriding consideration for the rest of this presidency. They've decided Barack Obama is not anyone they want to or can make any deals or compromises with, and if they can mess up his policy, they will. But also, there's very hard-nosed electoral considerations here. It's to do with the roots of the Republicans certainly in Florida, where you've got a lot of Cuban exiles who have never been reconciled.
It is a Republican congressman from Florida who is behind this bill.
Well, of course, because however much some of the exiles will look forward to easier contact with relatives in Cuba, very many of them have made a lifetime's work out of raising the flag against Castro. And any deal to make things easier for the Cubans flies in the face of voters in Florida.
Sebastian, the rationale being given by the Republicans is that they don't want U.S. scheduled flights to land at what was a partly U.S.-owned airport in Havana when the communists seized it. Do we buy that as a line of argument?
No, we don't. But we're quite happy because, airlines in Canada and Europe can fly all the Americans over if that's what they want. That's
fine. Well, once permission is granted, and there are suggestions that Obama may veto this.
That's
this,
the
this
other thing.
Well, that's
it'll
it's
be really ping pong.
It's gesture politics because he can veto this, and he probably will. I mean, if he wants his Cuba initiative to last and to have any real validity, he's got to make sure it's implemented more or less in full. And to take the whole heart out of it, which is to make it impossible to go there, then that would stymie any investment or anything, any closer relations. He's got to veto it. And the Republicans probably know that, but they can therefore afford to make this kind of grand gesture of we're upholding freedom and liberty and all that.
I wanted to come back to you about the point you were making about the political resonance in the United States, especially as we look to next year's presidential election. I can see that, as you were saying, beating up on the Castros may help in Florida. And as we learnt in 2000, that can be a fairly important state. But across the rest of the United States, outside of Miami, does anybody still really care about this? I mean, it's a self-evident absurdity, isn't it?
Well, people don't really care because it doesn't affect them, but they do care about going back on something that's been a long-held principle for their party for a very long time. And even if they themselves are not directly involved, they don't have any relatives, they don't know much about Cuba, they sort of feel, well, Republicans have always stood for opposing this tyranny and this regime.
Well, indeed, so have the Democrats. It was a Democratic president that nearly destroyed the world over Cuba.
Well, yes, that's true. But of course, that's when the whole policy began. I mean, we are talking, as you say, a long time since then, and it doesn't seem to have much relevance. And the US does business with a number of countries that have a much nastier regime, and people are still allowed to go there. It is really just a question of, I think it's almost like a sort of touchstone. It's like the Labour Party in Britain for years and years insisted that their effective policy was nationalisation of the main industries in Britain, long after that ceased to be either relevant or implementable.
I mean, do you think the same thing, Sebastian? Is this just a weird obsession of sort of the Republican Party and Florida Republicans in particular?
I wonder whether it will hold, because in the end, in America, as in Europe, you can't get elected on silly, radical ideas like that. I think, you know, the second Obama victory after a pretty lackluster first term, I think has proven that Americans are just as rational as anybody else. You've got to win the election in the middle. And so I can't see them insisting on this idea. It's a nice gesture for Southern Republicans, fine, but then he provokes a presidential veto, and then everybody will move on.
But I think you've gone to the heart of it there, which is about the electability and credibility of the Republican Party now, because you're absolutely right that if you have a party with a way-out extreme view of the world and of politics, they won't be elected. But the Republican Party at the moment is still in thrall to the far right. It's to the Tea Party group and to the people in, you know, the challengers on the right who are making all the running. And as long as they're the ones who've captured the ideology and heart of the party, I agree with you. I don't think they're electable.
Maybe they'll get another hit in 2016 and then move on.
a final thought from each of you on this. I mean, is this just the Republicans trying to sort of like sweep history backwards? 5 years from now, is there any way at all that the United States and Cuba won't have entirely normalised relations?
No.
No, Michael? I agree. No, of course they will.
Okay, well, finally tonight, and on the subject of Canute-like efforts to roll back inexorable tides, we turn appropriately to Denmark, one of whose MPs is vexed by the incursion of the English language to the extent that he believes its use should be taxed. Alex Aronson, who is culture spokesman for the somewhat cranky far-right Danish People's Party, is upset by private corporations and government initiatives using English phrases and thinks they should be made to pay for the privilege. Sebastian, you live in a European country in which many people speak better English than most English people. Is this man just, you know, is this story basically attention seeker seeks attention, or does he actually have a point?
I think it's marvellous, particularly, particularly because he talks about the beautiful Danish tongue. Now, I'm a great admirer of all these great TV series having come out of Denmark.
Indeed,
recently.
So.
Borgen and all, 1864 now, great. But to be honest, listening to the Danish language, I say that with all due respect as a neighbor, I wouldn't call it beautiful. I mean, it's evocative, maybe.
These are the views of Sebastian Borger, not of Monocle 24, speaks very highly of Denmark.
I certainly do. But seriously, I mean, we have the same problem in German. And he of course, is referring to advertisements, and we've had study after study in Germany that companies use English words in advertisements. People have no idea what they mean,
yes.
or in fact think they mean something else. So I mean there is a serious point there, but of course completely useless to attempt to do anything about it.
It should be noted that even Mr. Aronson's own party's leader sat on his idea pretty quickly. but it does lead to the interesting wider question. And Michael, I also grew up on a monoglot English-speaking island, and it occasionally rather strikes me that countries like Australia, countries like Britain, to a lesser extent the United States, are rather profiting unfairly from the fact that we are so bloody useless at teaching languages to our children, with the result that everybody else has to learn ours.
Well, indeed, yes. I mean, it is a question of simply market domination, and it's absolutely striking wherever you go. Any airport now, you go in the arrivals hall, every single advertisement, wherever you are, is in English, because they're attracting international, global travellers, and they think that's the common language. Or if you walk down a street, for example, the main street in Istanbul, every single shop has got some word saying, you know, sale, or some word, or the name of the shop, or some English-sounding word that is not native Turkish. Now, taxing it is a fun idea, and of course the Danes are very good at fun ideas. I rather like the defence policy years ago of one of their far-right parties, which consisted of a whole lot of microphones, or loudspeakers rather, at the borders, where it had recorded messages in Russian saying, "We surrender." And that was a way of doing it. But they come up with these wacky ideas. It's much better than what Quebec came up with, which was actually criminality for using English in advertisements. I mean, they actually made it a criminal offence.
But Sebastian, is there any point, do you think, in trying to legally defend a language? I mean, France passes laws on how many French language songs must be played on radio, etc., etc., etc. And I know so many people who've moved to, especially who moved to Berlin, English people who moved to Berlin because it's a great city and the rent was cheap, who did the thing of trying to learn the language, and all of whom told me this is the worst place in the world to try to learn to speak German, because as soon as you sort of start with your phrasebook German to one of the locals, they just start talking to you in completely perfect English. Is there any point in trying to actually legally protect a language?
First of all, say I think it's very important to still attempt to learn other languages, and I always appeal to my countrymen to be a little more patient with foreigners, and just listen to them and try and improve their German rather than, as you say, simply switch to English. There's absolutely no point in doing, you know, in wasting parliamentary time on making new laws? No. What you should do, and I think what at least this guy has done in Denmark, and it happens in my country as well, is to have a public debate about, do we actually need it, you know? For example, someone somehow came up with the idea of calling a mobile phone in Germany a handy. In other words, imitating, a for English word, which doesn't exist in the English.
Well, almost the worst thing I found is when, in the very rare occasions, British people have used a slogan in another language, namely Audi, where they say Vorsprung durch Technik, they pronounce it in such an appalling kind of English-style way, Vorsprung durch Technik, or something like that. You think, what on earth are they doing?
I still have no idea what that means. On that note, we will have to leave it there. Michael Binion and Sebastian Borger, thank you very much for joining us. That's all for this edition of Midori House. It was produced by Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tamor Williams. Our studio manager was Chad Chalvers. For the next half hour, Fernando Augusto Pacheco is also here with Monocle's international playlist on the Atlantic Shift. Marcus Hippie follows at 1900 hours with The Menu. At 2200 hours, it's The Daily with Emma Nelson and Peter Cardwell. This show returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.